Welcome to the McGuff Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James, celebrating Hercules Day. before we get started, we want to get you to check out our website, themcguffmen.com. We have, well, all of our old content up on there. Last week, we talked about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Before that, we talked about Drinking Buddies and Mumblecore a little bit. We've discussed Fargo, both the television show and the film in one podcast, 21 Jump Street, 22 Jump Street, The Shining, Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And you know, a variety of things.
Rocky, Michael Jordan.
Well, yeah, okay. Anyway, so check that out, themcguffinmen.com. Also, you can follow us on Twitter at themcguffinmen. We keep you up to date with basically everything we're talking about, new episodes. Sometimes we go on tweet rampages about new movies. Our Hercules tweet rampage has garnered rave reviews this afternoon, James.
Good to know.
Yeah. But we are not talking about Hercules. We probably never will be outside of this. But yeah, we'll just get to the theme song, which is once again brought to you by Ivory Hours. Check out their website, ivoryhours.com, and contribute to their crowdfunding campaign. If you're listening to this within the 2 hours after I post it, they've got a show at the Horseshoe Tavern tonight. Otherwise, just give them money for the crowdfunding campaign because they're actually good. All right. You are the missing two. The missing two. Okay, James, the lack of bongos in that theme song does not properly indicate what movies we're talking about here today. But no. Dave Holmes was unavailable.
So we have to settle for Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 12 and a dash of Ocean's 13?
Yeah, just a dash because Pacino's in it, so I have to mention it.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, we were talking about the 2001-2004 Steve Soderbergh films, not the Rat Pack 1960s.
Exactly.
Ocean's 11.
Which is all. Have you ever seen the 1960s one?
No, I haven't.
It's good. I like it. I grew up with a lot of Rat Pack in my home, so that's part of it. But it has a legitimately fun ending, like a really, really interesting idea at the end that I like a lot.
Alex grew up poor and there were rats in his home. Then he later got into Frank Sinatra music.
Look, Sammy Davis Jr. is a black one-eyed Jew that made it in Hollywood in the 60s. Like, that's pretty impressive. How can you not love that?
Very impressive. Yeah. I don't think people are still doing that. So
no,
good for
exactly.
him. Yeah, so 2001, 2004. Mm-hmm. I guess we'll start with Ocean's 11. You know, a heist ensemble comedy,
yes,
I guess?
Absolutely.
How's that? Directed by your boy, Double S, Steve Soderbergh.
My boy.
No, you wouldn't say that's true?
Oh, it's 100% true.
Okay.
He's definitely my boy. I was very surprised you referred to him as Steve earlier in this podcast, like less than a minute ago. I was like, well, I can't believe you are the first MacGuffin man to call him that.
Steve.
He got out.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, where to begin?
Yeah, I think my question is like, where does this movie start? Like, who has the first idea we should make Ocean's 11? Is it the studio? Because it seems like something that George Clooney would have willed into existence, but George Clooney wasn't famous enough at the time to like will a movie with this much money into existence, I don't think.
Yeah, this is 2001, so he's definitely famous, but he has, like, when does he achieve?
He's still the guy from ER at this point.
Dr. Doug Ross?
Yeah, sure. I guess you watched more ER than I did. Sorry, you cut out. Your excitement for ER cut your voice out.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of get the vibe that this is a Clooney thing, too, mm-hmm. and being helped out by Brad Pitt, who certainly has made it by this point.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Matt Damon.
For sure. And Soderbergh, this is the peak time for Soderbergh. We're coming right off of Traffic and Aaron Brockovich. So he's got an ability to get Julia Roberts in a movie, and he's never been more a bigger name in filmmaking. So he can sort of draw actors to the part or to the movies. And, you know, basically once you get Brad Pitt in a movie, particularly in 2001, things are going to kind of fall into play. But I suppose my idea was always that this was sort of willed into existence by George Clooney. But thinking about it over the last couple of days and starting to realize it must have been like a studio thing. And then George Clooney just kind of ended up in it. Because didn't I read that Bruce Willis was offered the role of Danny Ocean?
I believe he had signed and then backed out. Like for scheduling conflicts or something. So
yeah,
the whole idea of Clooney getting this underway, I don't think carries that much water.
No, absolutely not. And I was shocked when I read that, just because I was like, Danny Ocean is George Clooney. Like, this is the perfect role for George Clooney to do. He doesn't do anything but be hot and charming, you know. Like, and those are the two things that Clooney excels at.
Yeah, he's not that hot. Anyway,
please.
Yeah, but at the same time, this doesn't seem like much of a hard sell to me. Like, the Rat Pack's always cool, and to make obviously getting the money and getting the cast would be tough. But, you know, just a comedy Vegas heist movie, you know, with an ensemble cast, if you can get it, I think I don't know. What was that Casey Affleck?
Casey Affleck what?
Movie Jerry, where they're like walking in the desert for 2 hours.
Yeah, with Damien and Casey Affleck.
Yeah, like
Gus
this
Van Sant joint.
Yeah, this isn't like an insane idea. You know what I mean? Like, this is, people love the Rat Pack. You know, this looks like a movie. Hey, let's get a bunch of big people in here and let's have some fun. Mm-hmm. And you just get this out of the way now. You love this movie way more than I do.
I think it's fun as shit. I don't know that I love it. You know, I just enjoy it.
Okay. Well, even then, you like it more than I do.
Okay,
but I will absolutely give it, that is a very fun movie at times. Like, it seems like everyone's having a blast making it. And I mean, right off kind of the beginning of this movie, we get that Hollywood angle as we get Brad Pitt teaching current teen heartthrobs or
current teen heartthrobs and the girl from Charmed.
Yeah, who I had to look up. I had no idea who that was.
Everybody has to look her up, particularly in 2014.
Yeah, true. Mm. So we kind of get this.
Did you recognize the guy from Seventh Heaven, though? I just mean this is like a question.
I recognize him, but I couldn't identify. Like, okay. I couldn't have told you it was Seventh Heaven.
Sorry, continue on.
No, but we get this, you know, the Hollywood angle, and they hit it pretty hard on the head right away with these, you know, five new people, and then Brad Pitt being Brad Pitt as well. Not being Brad Pitt, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's something we see a lot of in this movie. Like, this movie is very, tons of kind of Hollywood insider humor. This and the next movie.
Oh, yeah.
Are just kind of full of it, and not just because it's an ensemble cast with a lot of people, but tons of kind of in jokes and Topher Grace being the hilarious human being that he is.
One thing I love so much about Topher Grace in Ocean's 11 specifically is when he's walking, or the scene begins with him trying to convince Rusty, Brad Pitt's character, to let him pay checks for these poker training sessions, and as there's a sort of a wide shot of them walking to the back room through a club, Topher Grace does like rubs the back of his head, like runs his fingers through his hair, which is a total Brad Pitt move. Like, he does that so frequently.
Yeah,
and I found that really funny. Whether or not Topher Grace meant it as a Brad Pitt thing, I thought it was fucking great.
Oh yeah, and Brad Pitt does that all the time, even when he has a shaved head. Like, yeah, it's not about having long hair bothering you, it's just that's a Brad Pitt move.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, for me it's Topher Grace going, it's only pocket change.
I feel like Pacey has a pretty good line at some point too. Or does Pacey have like a weird earring maybe?
Oh yeah, he's got a gold hoop earring.
Yeah, there's something great about Joshua Jackson's part in this. I just can't remember what it is.
It's that he's Joshua.
Yeah, that's probably got something to do with it.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked about it, but this movie's kind of defined by its ensemble cast and having just tons of huge names in it, right?
Three huge names. Matt Damon isn't really a huge name at this point.
No, I guess not. 2001.
Yeah, because the closest he comes to being a star pre-Born Supremacy is Born Identity. Like, the Goodwill Hunting made money and made him kind of famous and known, but still in kind of like a teen heartthrob sort of way. He's not on the level of Brad Pitt or probably would George, like, Brad Pitt and Julia Roberts are the only honest to God movie stars in this movie when it's made. And I think George Clooney's like on the precipice and nobody really knows whether or not Matt Damon will really make it. And then Born Identity gets him closer. And then Born Supremacy is like the big surprising hit that sort of elevates his role in Hollywood. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I remember when Ocean's 12 came around, Matt Damon was kind of talking in interviews about how he was tired off after Born Supremacy. And he's like, okay, I've got Ocean's 12 coming up. I can just kind of take a back seat. I'm just one of the gang in this movie. And they wanted to up his role for Ocean's 12 because he was now a bigger star.
You know, he kind of thought he could be one of the 12 and have a 12th of a role. But yeah. George Clooney goes, Danny Ocean goes to jail and he's kind of forced into this leadership position, which people have different feelings about in Ocean's 12.
Yeah, yeah. But let's keep it with Ocean's 11 for now, I guess.
Right. What I did want to say about kind of people's level of fame and the ensemble cast in this movie is, did you notice Don Cheadle's uncredited in this?
Yeah. There's something about he wanted higher billing than they were willing to give him or something like that.
Yeah, I think he wanted to be above the title, and then they said no, and then he said, all right, we'll just take my name off the whole movie then. Yeah.
Which is great.
That's a great story. Yeah. Another, like,
I don't know. Like, a more cockier type of thing than I would expect from the Cheed, I will say that. He seems a bit less, I don't know, like he wouldn't care all that much about having his name above the title, or at least that's what his career would indicate, but I guess he's like the rest of us.
Yeah. Maybe at this point in his career, who knows?
Yeah. And he was coming right off Traffic, and he's kind of the second, but I don't know, or at least he's my favorite part of Traffic, but anyways, continuing on.
Okay.
He's great in that movie.
He's great in, do you think he's great in this?
I don't know, I just... He's fine. I don't. He's not like my favorite of the gang or anything, but he makes me laugh a bunch of times. The Barney Rubble trouble thing makes me really happy every time.
Yeah, that part's funny.
Yeah.
He's just so like painfully over British to me. Like,
see, I don't have a problem with that. I feel like that really. I've read people like hating it, and he hates the accent now, and or like soon after this movie, and it's just like it's fine. It fits in this movie, you know.
Yeah, no, and it's not, to me, it's not even the accent. Like, you know, he's got a Cockney accent, which always sounds so, like, cartoony and exaggerated to me anyway. Mm-hmm. It's the dialogue. Like, he's got the, hold on to your knickers is, like, his first line.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
The next line, he calls someone a tosser. Like, yeah. I know these are things British people say, but it was a little too much for me. And I didn't, like, the accent didn't bug me either. It was only until I was researching this after that I see people are like, this is on the list of like worst movie accents ever and yeah. Stuff like that.
Well, number 1 through 50 on that list should be Kevin Costner and Robin Hood, and then we should just stop making the list. Yeah. It doesn't really matter.
Okay.
Maybe Colin Farrell in a couple things.
Do you have a favorite of the gang then?
Oh man, I mean,
Danny?
Just the top 3. It's just it could go in anyway, like they all have their highlights. I love with the exception of Contagion, Matt Damon in any Soderbergh movie is always playing that sort of like comedic Matt Damon role that I just love so goddamn much. And yeah. He's really great in Contagion. It's just a much more dramatic performance. I love everything with Matt Damon in these movies. He's just so funny to me. But I love movies where like this is Brad Pitt and Clooney's respective wheelhouses is this type of movie where they can just be charming, you know, and it's sort of where the movie is all about not restraining their charisma so much as harnessing it, whereas most of the time their performances are like you're kind of distracted by how charismatic they are, you know. Whereas yeah. This one, the whole movie relies on them being you know, you wanting to watch them while something else goes on around them, you know?
Yeah. It's got to be Matt Damon for me. Like, yeah, I think he's the best part of this movie by far. And he's the best, like, he's the best character. Like, I do really like his performance, but he's the only character that seems to be somewhat two-dimensional. Like, to have any
one, let's give him 1.5 dimensions.
Yeah, okay, that's okay. But yeah, Clooney and Brad Pitt, as you said, are just kind of, you know, in sixth gear the whole time of just trying to be charismatic and charming. And yeah. I mean, that's always, it's always fun to watch people pull that off. But yeah, I think Matt Damon's great. And I like how he gets to be that kind of meek, shy, confused, intimidated Matt Damon for most of the movie. And then once he starts posing as the Nevada Gaming Commission and kind of has to like really put everything into place. I think that's awesome. And I think that con is probably like, or that aspect of the con is one of my favorite ones when he gets Frank, you know, almost or fired, I guess, but as part of the plan. And then he plays the race card and they have that fight and he's just like, oh God, hiding behind Andy Garcia. Like, that's fantastic to me. And, you know, it's him kind of playing the intimidated guy, but doing it, you know, as the different guy, like having enough confidence to be this whole other person. And yeah, that's like one of my favorite parts of this movie to me.
Yeah. And him in the back of the van with Virgil and what's the other one's name?
Turk.
When they're having their argument and we've just sort of got this camera on Linus in the back and the jump cuts of him just getting more and more annoyed. It's so great.
Yeah. And those two brothers again, like they, some of my favorite parts of this movie is just them arguing. Yeah. Like I had Casey Affleck appreciation coming into this movie. I have more Scott Conn appreciation.
Oh, Scott Conn's a gem, man. If you put him in the right place, he's so funny to me.
Yeah. See, I did not know that. And I find him hilarious. And like in 11 and 12, just their little arguments the whole time being so petty and like, I'll give you $1 million not to talk for a month. yeah, they're hilarious to me. And I like Living Stindell, Eddie Jemison as the tech guy.
Yeah.
He's pretty wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're just saying that because you got to see him be a stand-up comedian in the next movie.
Yeah. Which I do. I love his joke, too. So let's talk about the dialogue in this movie.
All right.
Do you like the kind of like rapid fire snappy dialogue that we get a lot? Like the, I guess in this one, I'm thinking Tess and Danny's dinner scene when they first see each other again.
Yeah. Does he make you laugh? He doesn't make me cry. That's an exchange that I remember a lot.
Yeah. You know what your problem is? I only have one.
yeah, exactly. And it's just, that's one of the things I find so interesting about this movie. Is how old-fashioned it is. And those conversations with Danny and Tess are very notable for that. And the way the movie is shot is very... I mean, Steven Soderbergh loves the 1960s in filmmaking, and it's very obvious here. But there's just so many things that are both made specifically to be very old-fashioned, that dinner scene, and also that are made to play off the old-fashionedness. Like when Brad Pitt and George Clooney are talking in the early stages with the with these blueprints, and Clooney gives this big speech about when the right bet comes along, you take the house. And then Rusty calls him on it. He's like, you've been rehearsing that. And he's like, yeah, did I go too fast? I felt like I went too fast. Like, and it's just sort of this conversation with just these old fashioned elements. They're still very much a part of this movie. The way the movie's staged is very old fashioned. But it's just, it's all about making it sort of a modern version of an old thing. And in a way that I find very interesting and is kind of the only version of this that I've seen. Yeah,
that, like, because
they're total outliers from Hollywood, I think, these movies.
That speech that you were talking about, that would be in an old-fashioned movie, but we just don't get that follow-up about it being, you know, practiced. Like,
that could be in this movie and nobody would have batted an eye, you know, like, right. if we don't get the Rusty calling him on it.
You think so?
Yeah, because it, like, it's a decently written piece thing that you think Danny would say.
Yeah, I guess so.
And Clooney has the gravitas to get that type of stuff across. You know, he's one of like maybe two people that can't, and the other one's Brad Pitt.
What else do you find, like, in particular, what else do you find old school about this movie? Because it seems really modern to me.
Okay. Well, I think the way the movie is staged is very old fashioned.
Okay, you said that. What do you mean?
Yeah, okay. Well, when you said pick your favorite person from the gang, my first person that I wanted to say was Steven Soderbergh. Because he's the unseen fifth Beatle of this whole thing.
He's in there.
Is he in this movie?
Yeah, or he's in the first one or the second one.
Is he actually?
Yeah, for sure.
Are you sure you're not mixing up the bald Bruce Willis with bald Steven?
I am certain of it.
That's amazing. I've never seen him in these movies. Anyways, but you sort of get a lot of medium length takes in this movie where we get a variety of setups in one take. Say, something that's coming to mind right now is when Bernie Mac's character goes to buy the Vans with Virgil and Turk, and Virgil and Turk are like hanging off the back of this van, bouncing up and down. And then we sort of get a quick whip pan over to Bernie Mac talking to the dealer. And we get that without a cut. We get two distinctly different setups. You get a lot of long dolly tracks and zooms combined in this movie to sort of make one take into three to four different shots. My favorite shot in this movie is when, or one of them is when they're sort of unloading a van, like over a conveyor belt type of thing. Like, you know, they're whatever you would call the conveyor belt type thing that's at a beer store, you know? It's not a real conveyor belt. You got to push it along. And you sort of get shot of the first person moving these boxes. And then you get a shot of Brad Pitt pushing them along. And then we get a shot of Matt Damon catching the boxes while having a conversation with Danny Ocean. You can see Elliot Gould and Carl Reiner in the background. And it's all of these whip pans in between these things. I think there's a dolly move at the very beginning of that shot, and it's all in one take. And it's all of these really high paid actors doing the work of extras in this very complicated shot that would have taken a lot of time to block. And it's amazing. It's so crazy. And that is the type of thing that doesn't happen now. Soderbergh can't do it now because Soderbergh can't get the money to this type of money, and never did outside of these Oceans movies, and never will again. Very few people with the access to this kind of money have this sort of mentality. And Soderbergh makes this movie feel like a very expensive movie from the 1960s visually. You know?
Yeah, it's expensive's the word for it.
Like, yeah, for sure. But the thing is, like, the thing that the money in this movie really buys is one, Julia Roberts, and two, the time with these people to get these complicated shots. Because it's not an effects-heavy movie. It's not the way we would look at a movie and say, wow, that movie looks expensive now, you know? It's not like we're watching the Guardians of the Galaxy and we can see, oh, that probably cost $1 million, you know? It's sort of just this feeling that permeates throughout the movie where you know it feels expensive, you can't really point to why, and it's just because they had time to do all of these things, you know? And they had the money to make things work like this. And the other thing I find very old-fashioned about this movie, and I was curious to know your opinion on it, is there's a lot of visual humor in these movies. And that's something that really don't get a lot of outside of Edgar Wright movies anymore. As far as, say, we talked about Matt Damon leaving the van, right?
Yeah.
He gets out of the van, goes in through the entrance door, while the other guys, like, 2 seconds later, roll the pinch out through the other door. And that's the joke, is that, haha, he left too early, you know, and you get a little chuckle out of that. And there's a number of things like that where the joke is not found in improvisation. It's found in the staging of a shot. And that's something that used to be a lot more common in humor. And the way that comedy works now is that it's so improvisation heavy that you just, I mean, you don't get a lot of visual gags in an Apatow movie, say, you know? And that's very much a sort of modern comedy style. It's just, we keep everything in the wide shot because you never know when Seth Rogen and Paul Rudd are going to say something funny to each other, right?
Yeah.
Whereas with this movie, you get a lot of visual gags. Did I mention the monster truck at the beginning? One of my favorites is in 12 when Brad Pitt and or Rusty and Danny are just having wine on the couch together in the middle of the night, and Clooney just straight up misses the glass on the wine pour entirely, and it's funny, and it's just it's a really nice setup shot that has a joke within it, you know?
Yeah, and it's, you know, you get about like probably 60 to 90 seconds of just dialogue before you get that visual joke, too. Like, exactly. It's not like, let's cut to this so we can do the wine thing. It's, you know, you have a bit of dialogue and then you get that kind of payoff when you don't really need a payoff. Like, you're already, you know, building character, pushing your story forward, then you just kind of get this joke eventually, which it's like, oh, okay, that's kind of a bonus.
Yeah, and then you get a little additional joke when Rusty sips his wine, knowing nothing, like knowing that, not being aware that Danny just spilled wine all over his floor. You know, it's funny. It's
really funny. I love those kinds
and
of
it's,
jokes.
And it's thoughtful, you know, it's thoughtful humor, which I really enjoy. Like something about seeing a joke that I know is planned is funny to me, like adds an extra level of humor, you know? It's like, I mean, it's why I love Anthony Jeselnik so much, you know? Like there's not a lot of off the cuff stuff with him. Like when he's heckling people, it's great, but so much of his greatness to me is just in the fact that he's so highly constructed.
Yeah, no, he writes like very, very tight jokes. And I mean, this movie is it's fun and it's zany and it's, you know, it's got the ensemble cast and there's so much going on and it's busy and it's bright, like it's, you know, the Vegas, of course. There's tons of stuff going on, but it doesn't even when it's kind of like at its zaniest, it doesn't look thrown together. And no. I mean, that's totally to your point of, you know, those scenes where you just have you know, one of the best, you know, most famous actors in the world just kind of in the background or pushing a box and then doing one line and then, you know, going back to just pushing a box.
Exactly. It's sort of like the best way I could think of describing this movie is that it's highly controlled aloofness, you know? And that's kind of that describes Rusty and Danny for sure. And I think it describes the mentality behind this movie is that it's very well put together, but it's still so goofy, you know?
Yeah, no, and that's kind of like, I mean, if we go with the style of filmmaking and how that lines up thematically with what's going on, I mean, that's a con man, right? He's doing something off the cuff and, you know, whatever needs to be done at that moment, but he's always thinking long term. Like he has a much bigger framework in his mind for how to achieve whatever goal he has. And, you know, we see that also in this one with kind of the long con being played where we are in on on kind of the Ocean 11's scheme the whole time, like the actual characters, we learn their plan at the same time as they do. Like we, as Danny describes everyone's role in the heist, mm-hmm. We're learning everyone's role at the same time. Like we're really in their shoes. And then at the end we get stuck in, what's his name? Andy Garcia. Benedict.
Yeah, Terry Benedict.
Benedict. Right at the end, as you know, the big reveals come, we're in Benedict's shoes for the first time, and we've seen how much stuff went on that we didn't know about, like the SWAT and the pre-recorded footage and the, you know, using the replica bank. Just didn't know it was going to be used in this way. Like we were in with the gang for most of this movie and, you know, having fun putting it together, but they've tricked us. And by the end we are, you know, just a kind of another victim of the scheme.
Yeah, for sure.
And again, it's like just so perfectly lines up with, you know, what they do in this kind of business and just the characters they are kind of always having one pulling the wool over your eyes and being one step ahead of you, you know?
Yeah, for sure. One moment that I really loved that kind of ties into, or at least it's more we're in on this one, but goes back into the playing with Hollywood tropes type of thing. And it's just so funny. I think it needs to be mentioned is the scene where Brad Pitt pretends to be a cop. He's like, go find Griggs and tell him I need to see him. Just find him, will you? Like, I think that's so funny and such a great play on just cop movies or cop TV shows, I guess. And I think it's so funny. But it's just all kinds of moments like that where they're a step ahead. You might be with them, or you might find out 40 minutes later you're behind. But they're always in control.
Yeah, yeah, but it really surprised me when you described this movie as like old school, because I just didn't really think of it in that way. And the things that you did point out, you know, I think I agreed with all of them, but it seems so modern and not cutting edge, because I don't think it's doing anything new, but just willing to try things and being really highly experimental. When I think of older movies, you know, certainly there was experimental film in the 50s and 60s and things like that, but I think of things a lot more controlled. And there are just some visual things in this movie that, and especially in number 12, whatever you want to call it,
yeah,
that are just so wacky. Like
No, we're going to have a 5-minute break when we start talking about 12, where I just go.
Do you think there's a huge difference between 11 and 12?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
As for, like, the type of, sort of the way they're made, I think, is very different. But no, the one other way I want to sort of talk about how this movie is old-fashioned and, well, maybe we'll leave that to the end. Let's talk about 12 first.
Okay. Because this is the one where Brad Pitt eats something, right?
He does that in 11 too, I think, now that I'm thinking about it. I never noticed it before, but
let me rewatch.
Yeah.
Find me a screen grab of him not fucking eating in these movies.
Yeah. Anyways, I love Ocean's 12. My recollection of it was not very positive. And when it first came out, I remember seeing it with somebody and not being particularly impressed, and the person I saw it with being much less impressed. And I worked at a movie store, but I still kind of put this movie on every once in a while, Ocean's 12, just because, I don't know, just have it on in the background. And even like, this movie's not well liked among a lot of people. Like, I know one of our listeners, Kim, I remember tweeting like a year ago or something, today's an Ocean's 11 and 13 sort of day, but not 12, never 12. Which I thought was funny, and I was like, yeah, that sounds about right. And then I watched it again, and this movie's bananas. I love this movie so much, and mostly because it's kind of Steven Soderbergh's movie version of masturbating, which is great.
It's way better than just Steven Soderbergh masturbating.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But he was sort of in this position that he gets a little bit of this in Ocean's 11, but with the success of Ocean's 11, he gets even more freedom with 12. Is this place that filmmakers, really great filmmakers, almost never find themselves in, where they sort of get control to do kind of whatever they want. Tarantino could do whatever he wanted after Pulp Fiction. Paul Thomas Anderson had this with Magnolia. Fincher had it after The Social Network and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And, you know, mixed results. The best example is maybe Nolan making Inception after The Dark Knight. And sometimes people try and make a really like good movie out of it, and sometimes people just try and go balls to the wall and see what they can do stylistically. After Pulp Fiction, Tarantino decides, I'm going to reel it back. After Ocean's 11, Soderbergh decides, I'm going to turn everything that annoyed people about Ocean's 11, I'm going to turn it up to fucking 40, you know?
Up to 11? No, up to 12? Yeah. I'm not sure where you go.
No, just 40. Just okay. Going to 40. And that's what I love about Ocean's 12 is that it's such a visual movie, and such an interestingly visual movie, and it's very much just throw things out there, see what sticks. Maybe some of it sticks, but I really don't care, you know. It really felt like a Tarantino movie, stylistically, if Tarantino liked 60s movies more than he liked like exploitation movies. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. That's really the feeling I get from Ocean's 12. And it's very, very European, and very all over the place stylistically. Yeah. I like the con. I like the lifting of the house, I think, is great. I don't know. I just really like this movie a lot.
Well,
much more than I used to.
This shouldn't surprise you. This is Soderbergh's favorite Ocean's movie.
I read that in preparation for this and was like, of course it is. but like, I had decided after rewatching all of these again that 12 was far and away my favorite. And then when I read that, I was like, yeah, okay, this makes sense. Of course we agree.
Yeah. I think the house raising is really cool.
I thought you would like that for sure.
Oh, I love that. And that's the thing about both of these movies. I love heist movies and like con man movies and, you know, robbery movies. And you know, like my favorite parts of crime movies are often just like the actual mechanics of how you pull it off and not the kind of the drama of the result or whatever. But just all those like little tricks, like Jack Nicholson putting a analog clock under a tire in Chinatown to see when the guy left. Like those just tiny little things are what I love about these movies. And
that's what these movies are almost entirely. It's the tricks. It's not the things that the tricks lead to.
Yeah. It's those little things. And the house raising, I think, is a cool thing. I love it. Both of these movies really frustrate me though. Like it goes from something really funny to it just really drags for me for a while. Then they'll do something interesting, like, you know, like a little con, like, I don't know, just over, like, listening to the tech guys talk long enough to hear what stripper he likes at what strip club to pay her to steal his card. And, like, you know, just that kind of, like, legwork that they put in to do these things that you can totally, like, you can make this movie without that little bit. But I love those little bits.
Yeah.
I thought that house raising was cool. I thought number 12 especially, though, it doesn't escalate and then have a big, good payoff to me. I think number one ramps up and then the big reveal, you know, that moment we were talking about where we get put in Benedict's shoes and kind of start seeing what we've been missing for the last, you know, 20 minutes of the movie. I think that's great. I think that's a really good finish. I think number 12 really frustrates me.
You dislike what? Sorry?
Large parts of this movie.
Yeah.
And I really dislike the ending, and I think that the final caper, which should be awesome and great, is a really big letdown. Like, they started a fight on a train. That was kind of the big payoff.
That's what I love about it now, because that's what frustrated me for sure in 2004. I guess I saw it in early 2005, but that's what made me laugh in this movie, is that you sort of realize that the con happened around the 40-minute mark, or like the heist happened around the 40-minute mark, and the rest is the con. And I find that really great now, and especially since that train station scene early on, you know, it's the one where Danny's asking people, "Oh, you think I'm 50?" like, that's really funny, that scene. And almost immediately after that, still in the train station, Rusty says something along the lines of, "It's not in my nature to be mysterious, but I can't talk about it and I can't tell you why."
Yeah.
Which is so funny to me. And like, all of these, so many things happen at the train station, and then it's a really memorable scene that you then forget about until the end of the movie, when it's sort of realize that this is right before the biggest moment happens. And I think that's great. I think conning the audience is wonderful. I do think parts of the execution don't work. Like, I think it is, it's not clear enough why people are doing things while they're doing things. It's a bit too far ahead, even in its explanation. Like, I forgot why Lamarck was invested or why they still had to fool the Night Fox. Like, parts of these things go in and out. So it's not like it's perfect construction, but I love that idea of moving up the heist to the point that the rest of the movie, it matters, but not to the level that you think it matters. And I really enjoy that a lot now.
Yeah, no, and I fully get that, and I understand that. Early on, is that right?
What?
Catherine Zeta-Jones' character, Isabel?
Yes, Isabel Lahiri.
Isabel Lahiri, right. She says early on that Lamarck was like an expert at the long con, and, you know, if the ending of number one seemed like the long con, then number two is like the super long con.
Yeah.
Like, we get, as I said, you know, we kind of get fooled. We're in the Terry Benedict position for the last, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes of Ocean's 11. But yeah. We're conned for, yeah, as you said, like, since like the 40-minute mark of this movie. Mm-hmm. And again, I get how that fits in with the character and like the themes of the con men and the long con men and stuff. And I really like that idea on paper. I find the execution to be really, really unrewarding. And yeah, it just negates so much of the movie and so much of the script. And I mean, I have a ton of other problems with the rest of this movie, which I think, because that last part is negated and I find that last part pretty unenjoyable anyway, mm-hmm. then it really detracts from me. Like, I think the whole Julia Roberts thing is terrible. Like, that just really frustrated me. Okay. And often I really like the kind of like meta self-referential, like Hollywood in-joke stuff.
Yeah.
I thought this movie kind of got a little too far up its own ass. And for kind of the Julia Roberts thing to be as much of a plot point as it was, like, I'm okay with a cheeky little joke, but, and I thought that's what they're going to do when they were saying, doesn't she look just like, you know, I thought we were going to get maybe one or two more jokes like that. And then that was going to be it.
Well, I mean,
it becomes so central to the end. And I think it just does not work at all for me.
Well, the problem with that is that, I mean, if Tess looks like Julia Roberts, doesn't Danny look like George Clooney? So that's the problem with it, is that it's just sort of, it's an inconsistent logic. So, yeah, I understand that. I think I've never liked Julia Roberts more than in that scene, though. I think she's really great. Like, her face when she first meets Bruce Willis, I think is really, really funny. And I think there are some good jokes to be found within it. Like, when Linus is telling her that she was in four weddings and a funeral, and she's like, she wasn't in four weddings and a funeral. And Linus corrects her, saying, I wasn't in four weddings and a funeral. Just protect your fake baby. Like, there's some really good moments within there. But yes, I understand your point. And I don't disagree with it. But I think there are some gems to be found within it.
I think there's a few good jokes that we garner from it. And I think it's not worth it overall. Like, I do like when Bruce Willis is in Tess's hotel room.
Yeah.
And Linus is saying, you know, we're looking to come off this pregnancy thing strong. You know, that little statue on the mantle starts smirking at you after a while. Know what I mean? Like, that's a wonderful joke. And I mean, I guess I just think there is another way to do this. Like, make her a famous actress. Don't make her like a fictional famous actress. Don't make it Julia Roberts. But this movie is so it's so Hollywood and it's so full of the rest of that stuff. And I know I'm being contradictory because I've said on multiple podcasts, like, you know, I 21, 22 Jump Street, I love so many of the jokes about how it's about those movies. And we kind of had the opposite stance about 22. You thought it was way too on the nose, and I thought it was funny and interesting like that. But yeah, this one doesn't quite work for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like we would have said on that, or like I probably said to explain my position on 22 Jump Street, is that there's a fine line that you can't really define. It's just sort of a feel, and something either feels right or feels wrong. 22 Jump Street didn't feel right to me. Ocean's 12 doesn't feel right to you, or at least that section of it. And like I said, I don't disagree with your take on the test looking like Julia Roberts thing. I just think it gets enough laughs out of me that I'm fine with it. I'm also, yeah. I will say, I don't take these movies all that seriously. You know, they're just kind of fun rides that I don't think anything else has ever been like these movies as far as the whole construction of them. And I don't think will ever exist again. I think we're just sort of past this point of having really big, expensive movies that where all the money goes into visual things and the cast. And by visual things, I mean like practical visual things as opposed to spaceships exploding. Right. And yeah, I think they're really, that's one of the things I was saying about them being throwbacks, is that what does the modern version of Ocean's 11 look like?
Yeah, I don't know, because I thought these were the modern versions of Ocean's 11.
Well, I mean, 13 years isn't particularly modern anymore. And basically, we talked about this a lot on the podcast last week with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, but Ocean's 11, if it was made now, it's the Avengers. It's not getting a handful of these famous people together in one movie. It's getting a handful of these famous properties together in one movie. And that's why I don't think there will ever be another movie like these Ocean's movies. There's not going to be an Ocean's 14.
But I need more Topher Grace.
He's not even in 13. So if you watch 13, he's not there.
I need more. He totally phoned in that Dennis Quaid movie.
He has some, when he says, like, "Don't leave me, man," or whatever, when he's off screen and Brad's on the phone, I think that's so funny.
I like his "Your Boyfriend Wants Me" t-shirt.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, too. But
that's one of those old school visual jokes you're talking about, right?
Yeah, well, a lesser version. But the Avengers is kind of where we're at as far as a big ensemble movie, you know, like Robert Downey Jr. is maybe a movie star, and then Thor is the next biggest name in the movie, or Captain America is the next biggest name in the movie. It's not Chris Evans or Chris Hemsworth. I think that's a big part of the charm for these movies to me now is that I just don't think they can exist anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Everybody always talks about now how Clooney is a throwback. People were talking about that, I think, before this movie, the Ocean's 11 existed. And from the second Ocean's 11 existed, it just permanently sort of made George Clooney a version of Danny Ocean in all of our eyes. And that has maintained. And Brad Pitt, I think if you were to get the normal or the average person to sort of think about Brad Pitt, they would say something, they would think about something along the lines of Rusty, even though from like 2005 on, he's tried to do as much as he can to get away from that perception. Whereas George Clooney,
not just to be,
we talked about this on our Moneyball podcast like a year ago. Brad Pitt is the superstar character actor, whereas Clooney will play much more into what we want out of him, I think, more frequently.
Yeah, my big problem with these movies, though, is I'm not sold on Clooney in this movie. And I think so much of an appreciation of this movie totally involves you buying in on Danny Ocean.
Yep, I agree.
And it just misses for me. And I don't mind George Clooney. It's not like I dislike him or dislike all his movies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm obviously a much bigger Brad Pitt fan. I don't know what it is. I don't think it's I can't tell if it's the character or Clooney. I think you're just supposed to be sold on him from the get-go. And if you're not, then he never tries to win you over. It's just like, oh, you're one over already now. Enjoy how awesome I am for the next little bit.
All right. Well, allow me to counterpoint you here.
Please do.
Maybe, because I feel like that is not a popular opinion. George Clooney is my Leonardo DiCaprio, and vice versa, because I'm not a particularly big fan of Leo. I think that the common perception of Leo is totally wrong, whereas George Clooney, I buy into everything. I'm very, very pro Clooney. I find him very charming. I feel like him reading me anything would calm me down at any given moment. Like, his voice is so calming.
Yeah.
I feel like that's kind of... That's how I would have described Leonardo DiCaprio if Leonardo DiCaprio was playing Danny Ocean in this movie.
Yeah, and it makes me so curious to see what Bruce Willis would have done, because I do like Bruce Willis.
Yeah, I think they kind of excel at the same sorts of things of just being the most confident man in a room full of confident men, you know? Or people, I guess, if Julia Roberts is also in the room.
Forces. But we talked about on a...
Sorry.
Podcast. Okay. On our Die Hard podcast, we talked about how Bruce Willis's appeal was kind of that he was everyman, and I don't think that's the Clooney or Ocean vibe very much at all.
He is he's like the Uber everyman. John McClane, like he gets hurt, but he's still he's not taking a knee after he gets the glass in his feet. You know, like he's not crying in a corner. That's what the everyman would do.
Yeah, true.
If Clay, you know, like Hans's like fake American got glass in his feet, he wouldn't keep moving.
Yeah. Clay. Bill Clay. I love his American accent.
Oh, everybody does. Sorry, everybody who is smart does.
Yeah. What the fuck is Andy Garcia wearing in the first scene of Ocean's 12?
I don't know. I love those shots or those scenes of him rounding the gang back up, though. I think those are great. But yes, he's and his cane.
It's so weird.
Yeah, I mean, we don't need to get started on Andy Garcia. That guy's the worst.
That guy's a mess.
He's so he looks like Adam Sandler's dumber older brother.
Oh man. okay. I really like the intro of number 12. I thought that was good. Just the very first scene.
Oh, my God. It's amazing.
Yeah, Rusty kind of coming home to his girlfriend and then having to leave her right away, turning the shower on and just out the window.
Yeah, the scene is good. The shot construction is good. The freeze frame right before we start the credits is good. A lot of good freeze frames in Ocean's 12. I've started to realize that Steven Soderbergh is just the person that is good at that. There are some techniques in Hollywood that I'm just not crazy about that some people are just good at, and it's fine. Like, I like the freeze frame ending of Ocean's 12, which means it might be my favorite freeze frame ending ever, because I don't immediately hate it. And I think the only other movie like that is Out of Sight that uses freeze frames in a way that doesn't bother me. I don't think it's makes the movie better, but in Out of Sight, it certainly doesn't bother me.
What about Rusty finding out that Isabel has this cell phone and that freeze frame?
That's great. It's really funny. Yeah. One of the things that actually bothers me the most about Ocean's 12 is that it's profoundly wrong to me for him to not tell Danny that Isabel has his phone. You know, like, that's just so something that Danny should be in on.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my big problems of Ocean 12 is almost everything about Telluris or the Night Fox, whatever.
I like the Night Fox. I think it's fun.
No, I when he, like, him, you know, delivering lines and having dialogue is fine. Just the whole plot with the Night Fox and the fact that he's clearly the better criminal and that it's only Lamarck that allowed Danny and his gang to do well.
Yeah.
His fucking laser scene. Oh my God. That was like, I was getting really frustrated with this movie. And then that scene happened.
No, I understand that. I love the scene where we see him doing his morning training and it's intercut with, the Ocean's gang, like doing, I forget where they are in the plot, but there's a good scene of him just like in his white track pants or whatever, doing his morning stretches, intercut with the Ocean's gang that I like. But yes, I understand your problems with the elaborate dance sequence.
And it's so much longer than it needs to be.
It's quite long. It is quite long. Although I will say I really like it when he taps his heels together at the very end. I think that's very funny.
I'm fine with that. Yeah. Is this before or after Catherine Zeta-Jones entrapped our hearts with her laser sequence?
It's 5 years later. I think Entrapment was 1998, actually, now that I'm thinking about it.
Really? Oh, yeah. Man. Oh, that's too bad.
It would have been really funny if they did like that shot that was in every goddamn trailer.
Oh, I was so ready for that shot of like just Night Fox ass going right under one laser. And that, like, that would have saved that whole scene for me. And, you know, we just never got it.
Yeah.
Can I take a guess at one other shot that you haven't mentioned that I think you like a lot?
There's like 400, so it's not like you're...
What's Matt Damon's character's name?
Linus Caldwell.
Linus. How did I forget Linus?
Yeah, like when you texted me about how Tess is such a horrible name, I was like, you know there's somebody named Linus in this movie, right?
Yeah, I've always hated the name Tess. I didn't have as much exposure to the name Linus, I guess.
Okay.
Tess is all over my neighborhood growing up. No, when it's Linus.
Says the guy named James.
Linus and Virgil, I guess. Or, yeah, Virgil and whatever, Cheeds. Cheadle juice.
Bash.
Bash. When they're kind of, it's just the three of them left and they're standing in that room and there's that, when they're planning and it's just that one light is coming through the window or door right behind.
It's when Linus is doing his Danny Ocean impression.
Yeah, I really like that shot. That one is wonderful.
Yeah, and once they come up with an idea, the camera starts tracking in towards them. Like, it's sort of a moment of realization, and you get closer to the solution, and I like it. It's everything I like about this movie. It's the way that more so Ocean's 11 is constructed, in that it's a thoughtful shot. Ocean's 12 is more experimental, but there's a reason behind every move in Ocean's 11 still, you know, and that's pretty cool.
A well-constructed shot, and just you know, as you said, getting close to the truth, like carry some storytelling weight with a camera move, which is always nice. Mm-hmm. If it's not like too overdone, and I don't think this one was.
Yeah.
And Do you have anything more to say, or do you just want to laugh like Matt Damon and give a thumbs up when you're confused?
Just to continue with that point about visual storytelling, it is a lot more experimental as far as the visual style of 12, but there are still a lot of segments of the movie that are told almost entirely visually, with no audio other than music. And I think that's great. There's not a lot of purely visual storytelling that exists in movies, particularly at such a high budget. And I like that a lot about 12. There's a little bit of that in 11 as well, but particularly after the heist, when we sort of get them rounding each other or getting back together in front of the fountain, like that whole sequence leading up to it. And post-heist, pre-fountain in 11 is really gorgeous.
Yeah.
And told entirely without dialogue. And there are a number of sequences like that in Ocean's 12 as well that I really enjoy. My question, I guess, is why does Tess love Danny? That's the last question I have. Because it's
why does anyone like Danny?
Oh, shut up. and I think that's kind of what these movies are built around, is that you don't really know why you're buying into it, because like you said, they're all one-dimensional characters except for maybe Linus, who has 1.5, and that 0.5 is that he loves his parents, you know, like that's kind of all we know, or he's kind of afraid of them. And it just sort of, it's that brings people into Ocean's 11, and people loved Ocean's 11. From that point on, there's diminishing returns, but you know, in the average person's review of it, but that's something that I think is so interesting about these movies, is that celebrity is an elaborate con where you don't know why you care about it. And these movies are just filled with celebrity and not a lot of character. And you are there purely because there are some of the sexiest people in the world in this movie. And it doesn't really matter what they say, so long as they say it in a way that kind of charms you.
Three sexiest men alive and the brother of a sexiest man alive.
Oh, really? I didn't know Ben Affleck was sexiest man alive.
Yeah, he did.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for listening to The Guffman.
On that note,
we are going to go continue on our campaign to be the sexiest men of 2014. But yeah, be sure to check back on our website, themcguffman.com, for our next episode. Follow us on Twitter. And Ivory Hours will take us out. So go to ivoryhours.com/Mary to contribute to their crowdfunding campaign. And this is the last time we'll promote them to you. So do it now, because you won't get another reminder. Thanks for listening.
sitting on my bed, a mile